Ladies and gentlemen, good morning to you. Today is unfortunately the last day of our discussion on Great Zimbabwe. And I would like to spend the next 45 or so minutes discussing the meaning and interpretation. We looked at the origins. We also discussed the general archaeology. So based on that background or the foundation that we established in the first two lectures, today I will be presenting to you the different interpretations that archaeologists have come up with. Also, do not forget what I mentioned in the first lecture, that interpretations, they do change with time, and they also change with the social context. Having said that, one of the questions that you may have been asking yourself was that, because I showed you the different components making up Great Zimbabwe, the hill complex, the great enclosure, and the valley enclosures, were they part of a single settlement? Or they were just autonomous homesteads which are adjacent to each other? That's a question that people have grappled with since the 1940s. And if we say that, well, it was a single settlement, or they were different settlements, who was occupying the different enclosures? Who was living on the hill complex? How about the very impressive great enclosure? Who was occupying it? What was it used for? Was it for settlement, or it had other uses? Then, much more importantly, what can we learn from the organization and use of space at Great Zimbabwe? We are talking here about town planning, the fact that you have an enclosure having certain dimensions and in a specific place. Can we read meaning out of that? And lastly, what was the nature of politics and economic organization at Great Zimbabwe? All these issues are tied to the way archaeologists and related specialists have tried to interpret Great Zimbabwe. It has been a very challenging exercise, largely because there are no written records. So oral traditions, they don't go very far in time. At most, maybe 200 years, but that would be stretching things. So the archaeology is still our principal method of generating information. Somebody asked me yesterday about what was the nature of the houses inside the enclosures. This is a plan from Peter Garrett's 1973 book, Great Zimbabwe. So this is what the plan of those huts was. So you would have the hut here, and then you have all these different stone walls demarcating space. So what some archaeologists have done is that, using the observations from the oral history, from the recent past, reports from 19th century missionaries, they have tried to come up with meanings relating to how these huts were used, and more importantly, who was using them. I would actually be very keen to get your feedback regarding what you think about some of our interpretations regarding how these huts were being used, and whether that makes sense at all. So in terms of meaning and interpretation of Great Zimbabwe, let me start with discussing what Peter Garrick thought in 1973, because that was one of the earliest syntheses. He put together a whole lot of information, pottery, radiocarbon dates, the style of stone walls, the archaeological finds, from the different enclosures to come up with his interpretation. He says that all those constituent parts, the valley enclosures, the hill complex, and the great enclosure, they are part of a single site. He also says that there is evidence that settlement started on the hill, and the areas of the upper valley enclosures, that is the area adjacent to the great enclosure, where there are P-style stone walled enclosures. So that's what the settlement started like, and then it was extended over time to cover different areas. Peter Garlick also believes that the different enclosures of Great Zimbabwe were occupied by various officials, the king, his support staff, as well as his family. And looking at the chronology, as well as the typology of the walls, Peter Garlick believes that the hill complex started as the initial residence of the king at Great Zimbabwe. So the king was a resident in the western enclosure, and perhaps the rest of his family. Let's not forget that the western enclosure on the hill complex, I'll show you a photograph just now, is quite big. Peter Garlick estimated that you could fit 35 huts inside. So that's quite a big space. But then he said that over time, political succession may have shifted to somebody who was occupying the great enclosure. And that individual was responsible for making all those additions and elaboration. So according to Peter Garlick, the great enclosure is also a residence of the king, but at a much later stage in the history of the settlement. And from the great enclosure, succession was passed on to the valley enclosure. And that is also on the basis of material culture or archaeological evidence. That is the last place to be abandoned. That's the only place at Great Zimbabwe where archaeologists have found that Chinese blue on white porcelain. That is the valley enclosure. It hasn't been recovered from the great enclosure. It hasn't been recovered from the hill complex. So the expectation or the thinking then is that all these other areas were no longer occupied. And that seemed to get or to receive some support from Portuguese documents dating to the 16th century, in particular Antonio Bocaro and others. They argue that Great Zimbabwe in the early 16th century was occupied by a prince and somebody of a lesser importance. So this seemed to support Peter Garlick's thinking. However, archaeologists have had some reservations with respect to Peter Garlick's thinking. They said that he made some speculative statements without backing his thinking with evidence. Archaeology is an evidence-based discipline, so if you just make some statements, then it is tantamount to hand-waving, and it's not very, very helpful. But nevertheless, I will come back to Peter Garlick's thinking after presenting to you what other people thought. So from Peter Garlick, we move on to Thomas Huffman, who has done a significant amount of work at Great Zimbabwe. He dug at the place in 1974, and for about 10 years, he was employed by the then National Museums and Monuments of Rhodesia, and he was based in Salisbury. It was only in 1980 when he moved to take up a professorship at the University of the Witwatersrand, where he retired, I think, maybe 4 years ago. Tom Huffman is an American from Denver. He studied at Illinois. The reason why I'm giving you this background is that his way of looking at archaeology is different from what others, such as Peter Garlick, who are hailed from England. So the American background is such that archaeology is part of anthropology. So it's one of the four fields of anthropology. There is cultural anthropology, physical anthropology, archaeology, and then linguistics. So that's the approach that Tom Huffman has used or adopted to study settlements in Southern Africa, including Great Zimbabwe. So what he tried to do in his 1982 paper was to try and understand the use of space at Great Zimbabwe. So who was occupying the western enclosure on the hill complex? Who was occupying the great enclosure? Those are the answers. Those are the questions which Tom Huffman was looking to answer. So given that that is his brief background that I have given you, in the 1980s, in the early, late 70s, early 1980s, in global anthropology, the theory of a French man, Lévi-Strauss, the same Lévi-Strauss who sells those jeans and stuff like that, just for the spelling. So Lévi-Strauss popularized a theory known as structuralism. And structuralists believe that the world is organized in a series of opposites, so binary oppositions. If you have high, then you are also going to have low. And if you have left, you are also going to have right. If you have men, you are also going to have women. That's what structuralism is all about. And structuralism also says that everything starts in the mind. And after having been formulated in the mind, that creates the worldview. So, which is then materialized on the landscape through action, through building, and through doing all those other activities. So, using this kind of reasoning then, after everybody else agreed that, well, Great Zimbabwe was a Shona settlement. Being a very clever person, Tom Huffman then said, wow, there is this new thinking framework, which is called structuralism, and I can also get into the ethnography to understand how the Shona worldview works. So he was also able to come up with some of those binaries or series of polar opposites, like in his seminal papers, he studied these Shona, these huts. And what he was able to show was that at the center of a hut such as this one is normally a fireplace. Sure, we can all relate to that. And then there is a big platform here where pots are kept. And then to the right, you have a bench where men sit. And then you have the left side where women normally reside. The entrance is here, which is at the front. So talking about that theory of structuralism then and those polar opposites I was talking about, this is the back, which is also private, and this is the front, which is also public. In times of need, people offer sacrifices, prayers to their ancestors at that big platform. So, and then women would leave or occupy the left side, and the opposite of that is right, the right side, which is where men lived. So that's using this model, he just extrapolated it on Great Zimbabwe. In the western enclosure on the hill, that's exactly the model that he said. So to him, the left side of the western enclosure was reserved for women, and the right side of the western enclosure was reserved for men. The front was a public space, and at the back of the western enclosure, which is known as the eastern enclosure, was reserved for ritual purposes. So it's just that that logic that Huffman used. I'm going to elaborate on this with concrete examples from Great Zimbabwe, just to make sure that we are all on the same page with respect to Huffman's reasoning and also his interpretation of the use of space at Grace and Bible. So you may have been wondering, for example, if I say that yes, women were living on the left side and men on the right side, and then the front was for public purposes, and then the back was for more private activities. You may have wondered, how did he know? Or you may have asked that question, how did he know? Remember, we are talking about a place that existed 800, 900 years ago. But Huffman went into the local histories. He consulted Shona oral traditions to get some information on how do people organize themselves, especially within the homestead. And to him, that seemed to confirm that a series of binaries, that men would sit on the right side, women on the left, and then the back is private space. That's where women keep their pots, and that's where rituals are done. He also consulted Portuguese written records. These are relating to the Mutapa state, that state which came after Great Zimbabwe. In the first lecture, I may have mentioned that the oral traditions claim that after a shortage of salt, Great Zimbabwe was deserted and a new state was founded in the northern parts of the country. That is the Mutapa state that I'm talking about. It was in the sphere of influence of the Portuguese from the Zambezi Delta, as well as from the island of Mozambique. They commented on the activities that were taking place in the Mutapa state, including the use and organization of space. One such reports states that the king resided in a very big palace, which is known as Zimbabwe, and he lives there with his many wives. So extracting data from such documents, Tom Huffman was able to provide some support to his thinking. And also he consulted Shona ethnography and the reports of from people such as Posselt, who was a native administrator for the colonial government in the 1920s. There were also missionary reports. So where Huffman received criticism is that when he fails to get some support from the Portuguese documents and the Shona ethnography and oral traditions, he simply decided to cross the Limpopo River into modern-day Vendaland. And he took some Venda ethnography or anthropology. His justification being that the Venda were once Shona. Indeed, the oral traditions are clear that the founders of the Venda state, such as Djembeu and so on, they initially were part of what is known as the Changamire state in the Midlands of Zimbabwe. The state was based at Kanangombe or Oldolo, and then after some succession disputes, they decided to cross over. But the problem is that the Venda also interacted with Sotho-Tswana people and the Tsonga people, meaning that their worldview is now a mixture of different groups. So a number of anthropologists, they say that, perhaps that's the straw man in Huffman's argument. Nevertheless, I'm going to present it to you in full, and then give you maybe one or two points of witnesses. I said that Huffman was educated in the 1960s at the University of Illinois. That is very important, because during that time in global archaeology, they believed that archaeology is a science. It's not a social science such as history or anthropology. So archaeology was believed to be a science. And the way in which one constructs arguments scientifically is different from the way in which one constructs an argument in disciplines such as history or cultural anthropology. So scientists start with a hypothesis or a prediction. And then you look for data to validate that hypothesis. After you have validated it, then you come up with general laws, which you can apply everywhere. Historians don't work like that. So that's the approach that Huffman took. He said that because archaeology is a science, his model of looking at how the Shona people used their space, he must start by applying it in the 19th century. So there are stone walls dating to the 19th and to the 18th century, one of them being Danangombe, the Rosary capital, which is in the Zimbabwean Midlands. So he tried his ideas ethnographically, that is, at sites such as Danangombe. When it seemed to work, according to him, he then applied it to sites such as Kami. Remember, we said that Kami was occupied in the Owasapando during the 17th century, but elements of the Kami culture continued. So he used that until he applied it at Great Zimbabwe and Mapungubwe. And then he concluded that there is a goodness of it between the model that started in the 19th century through the 18th, 17th, 16th, 15th, up to around about the 12th century. So against this background, let me then present to you what Huffman says with respect to Great Zimbabwe and the reasoning behind it. So using that logic borrowed from cognitive structuralism, that the same group of people will share the same worldview. So the way they use their space is determined, or is predetermined in the mind. And what they will simply do is to materialize that ideology on the landscape. So using that methodology, Huffman identifies five elements at Great Zimbabwe, the first of which is the palace. So according to Tom Huffman, the king lived on the hill complex here. So he says that this was the palace at Great Zimbabwe. And the difference between Peter Garlick and Tom Huffman is that inasmuch as Peter Garlick believes that the kings may have lived on the hill and moved to the Great Enclosure and later on to the valley here, Huffman says that when Great Zimbabwe started, the first king was living here. And when Great Zimbabwe was abandoned, the last king was living here. So in other words, for the duration of occupation in Great Zimbabwe, the hill complex was the residence of the king. How does he support that? He goes into the ethnography. There are Shona proverbs which says that the king is metaphorically referred to as a hill. And when the king has passed on, there are some figures of speech that says that the mountain has fallen, or Gomorawa in Shona. So armed with that evidence, then he says that there is a link between the majesty of kingship and the majesty of hills. That's quoting from his 1996 book. So all these Shona settlements, homesteads, they also have a very important public space where people meet to deliberate on judicial matters, political matters, and any other issue affecting the health of the state. So according to Huffman, then, this is a map from his book. So you can see he has labeled here court. So, and courts are generally empty space. Nothing was built there. So he says that this area here was the court where all judicial matters were solved. How does he identify it as the court? Well, that's a little bit controversial. But he also notes that there are rubbish dumps in this section and in this section. And because there are no associated enclosures, he says that in the ethnography, hotspots are also associated with rubbish dumps. So there is no other open space in Great Zimbabwe which is associated with those rubbish dumps. So this must be the court. So the king was living there with one or two officials, his guards, and what he calls the ritual sister from Venda ethnography. And then this is the court where judicial matters were solved. The other critical component then is what Huffman calls the residences for the leader's wife. And according to Tom Huffman, these Mali employees, they were all occupied by the king's wives. He would be living in the hill, and the wives would be here. I don't know practically how that makes sense. Most of us have been to Great Zimbabwe, so the king right on top, I mean, it's also very difficult to climb, so he must have been very fit. But nevertheless, that's what we have. And how does he identify this area as the residence of the king's wife? He says that there is iconography on the stone walls that is consistent with women. So therefore, this must have been occupied by the king's wives. I'm going to present you the evidence that Huffman uses, which means that we are left with okay, residences of the leader's wives. Okay, there is this great enclosure. You can see that there is this passage which goes down to the valley. Huffman believes that this is a national initiation center, which was presided over by the king's chief wife, who was also living where are the renders ruins here. That's where the king's senior wife was living, and from here he could go to this, and was responsible for initiation. So that's perhaps one of the most controversial aspects of Huffman's interpretation. Again, there is a lot of iconography. For example, that chevron design, Huffman associates it with the young, and then there are also some designs here that he links he associates with the old and the wise in a series of finals. So in Huffman's world then, kings on the hill, wives in the valley, initiation in the great enclosure, and this is the public space, the judicial center. Then there's also these kings or rulers, they had followers. Where were these followers living? This is a perimeter wall, just a very, very low stone wall. There's that smaller one, which is known as the inner perimeter wall. This is the outer perimeter wall. So this area here to your left, that's where the commoners were living. So if we go back to that model of the hut that I explained to you, this becomes the front of the settlement, and then this becomes the back. So you can still apply those binaries, and you also have this court. So that's how things work in Huffman's world. Then, of course, if it is an important town, you would need soldiers, you would need guards. So these guards, they formed a protective ring, according to Huffman, and they would form a circle, circling the whole settlement, but that would include these commoners area. So that's the new meaning of Great Zimbabwe. In fact, it's not new, because it has been around since 1982. And it has been modified in one or two ways. This is just a diagram from Tom Huffman's 1996 book that generalizes, or that explains what I've just said to you. It says that if you start with settlement pattern A, then it will also give you an understanding of social organization X. So if you see a settlement pattern A in archaeology, then it means that the social organization is the same, and you can also connect to the worldview. So it's a cyclical type of argument, because it means that if we are at Great Zimbabwe and we have applied that model, we can come back to the worldview of the Shona people. That's where we have started, isn't it? And then we see the same settlement organization. And like I said, he started from the ethnography and the historical record, and then later on tested his model at Great Zimbabwe, and he said that the goodness of it is very good. And then we are told about elements of the Shona worldview, such as the king lives on high ground, and so the hill complex must have been the residence of the king. And there are also designs that appear on different elements of material culture. This is also a copy and paste from Tom Huffman's 1996 book. These are the symbols that appear on the stone walls at Great Zimbabwe. And this is how Huffman has explained them in terms of meaning. So starting from the top, if we see this check pattern, it represents the male crocodile. And he borrowed this from Venda ethnography. And wherever you see a stone wall with this design, it represents old and senior men, and it also represents wisdom. So therefore, that enclosure would have been occupied by people consistent with this description. Then, there's also the, if you have a male crocodile, you should also have the female one. And what does the female one look like? It also represents old and senior, and it's represented by this chevron design. And then he also talks about this crocodile in his pool, again an element derived from Venda anthropology. And these, if you see these designs on any article of any item of material culture or stone walls, you can associate that with the crocodile, and it means ritual seclusion. Ritual seclusion simply means, or simply refers to the physical separation of the leaders from their followers. They lived in those enclosures, and these other guys are outside. And also, a stone grain bin is associated with a male fertility. And also, this is represented by the towers. And then you can also have the horn, which are basically a stone monoliths. And there are also pharaohs in the field, which are related to female duties, and so on and so on. So this scheme of things was arrived at after synthesizing data from Portuguese documents, data from the Shona ethnography, and data from the Venda anthropology. So this is just the same map of Great Zimbabwe, just to... there are also other items of material culture. These are divine indices, which are used by Sangomas during their consultation. So how it works is perhaps they put them in the hands and then shake them, and then put them on the ground. Whatever site it comes, then they will read the meaning. But more importantly for our purposes, you see these different designs. This looks like a crocodile. And you can also see this chevron pattern and all these other designs. They are the same, or they are similar to the ones that we have seen on stone walls and on those soapstone bowls yesterday. So again, the meaning would apply. If you see this design, this means old men. These ones, old women, and then of course young men and also young women. So if you have seen these symbols on the stone walls at Great Zimbabwe, it means then you can be able to identify who was living in those enclosures. That's the whole basis of Huffman's argument. So all I'm just going to do now is to show you instances where you find the designs, and just to reinforce on what he thinks it means. Okay, this is a door to one of the Venda chiefs, and these are secular things according to Huffman. He conducted ethnographic work, and he was told that this represents
a crocodile's eye.
So at least he is trying to find some justification to show to us that the Venda ethnography is appropriate for understanding Great Zimbabwe. I talked about the need to test the model on the recent past before going to the deep archaeological past. This is the site of Danagombe or Ololo. You can see this pattern. And not surprisingly, Huffman associates this with the king's palace. This is where the king resided. Why is it so? It's associated with this check design, which is also, that's the other reason is that this is also the highest point at the settlement. And we know from the ethnography that kings were like hills, and the kings also occupied a raised ground. So that's how he has identified this raised platform as the residence of the king. So according to him, then there seem to be goodness of fit between the ethnographic observations and the material record, which is the stonework here. If you go to Kami, just outside Blawayo, you also see these chevron designs, and you see what he calls the zebra representation, and so on. And he also makes identifications, and he has identified the king's palace, the royal wives area, the guards area, the commoners, and so on. So according to him, all these settlements, they are organized following the same lines. Why is that so? It's because they were made by the same people who share the same worldview. So then their use of space, it can't be different. That is the rationale behind that. Then, he also associates it with senior women. If I let's go to the sometimes it gets confusing. So you're right. That's women. The power of women in this world. So from Kami, he also, as I mentioned, identified all the different enclosures with a specific group of people, and based on these decorations. So you can also see that this one is a very interesting wall, actually, because it also has this check pattern here. And that would be, I mean, under normal circumstances, people share spaces and so on. I was going to say that this is also one of the features that have attracted as much controversy as the interpretation itself. We have civil engineers here, and we have other people who have got a background in the construction industry. It will be good to hear your thoughts on this one. According to this, appears in the western enclosure at the hill, as well as in the valley enclosures. This seemed to be like a grove. So Huffman explains it using the Shona ethnography. There is what is known as the Mongwe or faro ditches. So faros for cultivation. And the faros are just the same as the field, and that is associated with women. So Huffman says that, well, this feature appears in a context that suggests that the spaces were used by women. What is more interesting is that if you look at Great Zimbabwe, there are some elements where you have exactly this grove, and there were wooden poles which were inserted in here for structural for construction purposes, and there are still one or two which are present. So some archaeologists were pointing the fact that aren't these fields simply a result of the fact that there was a port which was removed, and that would nullify this interpretation. I'm going to show you one example where the pole or whatever is still inset, and if you remove it, you are going to have this growth. So, in other words, critics of Huffman argue that in this case, perhaps it's overstretching things a little bit. But you can make up your mind when I show you the other element. And of course, this is one of those nasty roads leading up to the Hero complex. There are two ways of, maybe three ways of getting to Great Zimbabwe. There is that one which is known as the Ancient Ascent. That is very, very, very steep. And you can also approach it from the northwestern side, as well as from the northern side. So this is a very steep and a very, you can get very tired when getting up at this ascent. And Huffman says that it emphasizes that concept of ritual seclusion of the rulers. There is also a Shona proverb which says that if you are to ascend a hill, you don't do it directly, but you have to go in a roundabout way, which Huffman is taking literally here. He is saying that people are going to be to the king, and they are also going in a roundabout way. I mentioned that the hill complex is believed to be the residence of the king. That's a photograph from Peter Garrick's 1973 book. So this is the Western Enclosure. That's where the king would have been living together with one or two officials. But what is more important is this enclosure here, which is known as the Eastern Enclosure. Seven of those soapstone beds from Great Zimbabwe were recovered from this platform here. So because of its association with those soapstone beds, it is believed that it was used for ritual purposes. And in the Huffman scheme of things, this is also the back. So that's where ritual is done. There is the front, and this there is the back. On the basis of that hat that I showed you, remember I said that the back is where rituals are normally done. So that's the same logic which Huffman is using here. And what is the archaeological evidence for that? Even in terms of deposits, Theodore Bent and his crew, they didn't find any deposit in this area, which shows that it was not occupied. In contrast, in the Western Enclosure, that's where those very deep deposits were. So logically, according to Huffman then, that's the front and this is the back. So that's where the rituals were done. And as I said, that is also the place where those soapstone beds were found. I mentioned that those stone monoliths, they are linked to grain bins. They are also sometimes treated as phallic symbols. That is the Great Wall on the western side of the Great Enclosure. And indeed, this iconography, according to Huffman, is consistent with the king. Apologies for this very bad resolution, but I hope you will be able to see this guy here, which is a monolith. So just to show you that these are the horns of the king, because in the ethnography, kings are also seen as bulls, and they protect their territory using horns. Not surprisingly, on the walls of the Great Enclosure, you also see this horn here, and the kings were also supposed to be presiding over the fertility. You also have these small conical towers, which are grain bins. So, easy. This is the king's residence based on this iconography, just the map of, again, the Hill complex from Peter Gallick. That's where the eastern enclosure is, and there is the western enclosure. And you can see at the space, that's where the king lived, wined, and dined. This is one of the early photographs from Great Zimbabwe, probably from the 1920s, if not thereabout. You can see again those monoliths are speaking the same language. Well, this is this photograph is it was taken from the other side. This is what is known as the Watergate, and there is an entrance to Great Zimbabwe from this side, and the other entrance would be this end, and then the steep one is this way. A photograph of that's inside the eastern enclosure on the hill. Those are the platforms where I said that those seven soapstone beds, and some remains of the soapstone bowls were also found. Soapstone beds, seven of them found on the hill. What do they really represent? In the Shona ethnography, the beds of prey, such as the Bartolea eagle, they are seen to have an intercessory role. So they were used for communicating with the dead. So one interpretation from Huffman is that these soapstone beds were used for ritual purposes, and they were used, they represented the deceased kings of Great Zimbabwe, and they were used for ancestor worshipping. Then there is also this cave, which is just after the eastern enclosure. I'm sure some of you have seen it. This cave has got some very interesting acoustics. If you are here and you start talking, people who are in the valley, which is about 800 meters or more away, they can hear each and every word you are saying. So according to Huffman then, that was this cave was very, very important. That's where the national announcements were made to all the people in the town. If the king and other guys wanted to go, they would simply come here. The evidence to support that it's not that strong, except that it's true. If you stay here and talk, guys, the people who are down in the valley, they are going to hear you. So I don't know, but it seemed to be. I mean, anything can go. Perhaps. We have seen this photograph. Perhaps the reason why I have it is that I'm now shifting my attention to the royal wives area. And what is the evidence? Okay, this is the eighth soapstone bed. It was found in the Renga's ruin, which is part of the valley. And according to Huffman, the senior wife, known as Vaozi in Kishona, he or she kept the valued possessions of the king. There was also, remember I mentioned that there is a material culture consisting of coral, glass beads, some spoons, and many more from the Indian Ocean coast, which other people would like to think that they were a trader's possession. According to Huffman, no, this is not a treasure's, this is not a trader's possession, but those are the most valuable possessions of the king, which were being kept by his most senior wife. So that Renga's ruin then is the king's residence. So these are, you can see these poles, such as this one. If you remove it, then you are going to be left with that grove I was talking about, the Miombwe. And that's why I was saying that it seemed to be part of the structural engineering at Great Zimbabwe, and not that it had any symbolic significance. And not surprisingly, Huffman also uses the presence of this monolith, we might call it, to also suggest that it is associated with women. Therefore, he supports his argument that this valley area was occupied by women. Then there is this great enclosure. Alternative interpretations, it is a palace, that's a Gallic, and the residence of the first wife, as well as a national spiritual center. So that's what Huffman thinks. And briefly, I will make some comment. This is a photograph of the Great Enclosure. So because this is leading to the Valley Enclosure and to the Reva's ruin here, where the senior wife is living, and she is the one who is presiding over national initiation and so forth. Not surprisingly, this is a female area. This is the front, and also this is the male area, and you have the back where rituals and everything else are taking place. You also have the conical tower there. There's this parallel passage leading from the valley enclosures. There were also some metalworking debris which was recovered here, and there is what looks like a platform of clay. And Huffman thinks that that's where the speaker who was presiding over initiation was best. Again, he looked for support from the vendor. That's a shot of the Great Enclosure, just showing you what is supposed to be the male side. This is the conical tower coming on that. So talking of symbolism, you can associate, so this is young junior women, and then you also have old senior. And there was a pattern here, which is associated with old and senior men. And then at the back, you have young and junior men. So these, it gets confusing at times, because the use of those symbols and their meaning is not consistent. So for example, those monoliths, which we said they were horns, are on the hill complex. When we come to the Great Enclosure, they are now being used to symbolize young men. Why? I don't know. You can see the zebra pattern just next to the conical tower in the Great Enclosure is associated with junior men. So, in trying to wrap up, Thomas Huffman believes that we can identify any group's worldview, and that worldview is materialized on the landscape. By reading the use and meaning of space, we can actually identify the function of different spaces. That's what he has done at Great Zimbabwe via that convoluted route from the what's also known as the ethnographic present. However, the main weaknesses, the main weakness of Huffman's method is that, as we know, use and function are correlated. So if you say that enclosure A, or this Great Enclosure, was a national initiation center, the material character that you find there must be able to support that function. Is that reasonable or not? If you go to the hill complex, if it was occupied by the king, then the material character that you find must also be consistent with the king. But actually, the study of the distribution of material culture in all these enclosures, from the hill, the Great Enclosure, and the valley, it shows that the people who lived there all had access to exotic goods. They also had access to cattle. They worked there with evidence of craft production and so forth. Suggesting that perhaps these were fully functional homesteads. And more importantly, there is evidence of metalworking in the valley enclosures. And metalworking is a typical male pursuit. So who is doing that that metalworking? Because using the same ethnography that Huffman uses, it tells us that women were not metalworkers. So it means that they were staying with some men. I don't know who they were. But it's just a point of inconsistency. And the other thing is that it makes wonder whether these kings had children or families. Because we are only told about their wives and the kings. Where were the children? And where were the other people living? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that, except to point out that this is one of the major inconsistencies of Huffman's method. So somebody criticized Huffman of dramatizing the past. But in response, he says that it is better to dramatize a past than not to have one at all. So, ladies and gentlemen, let me end on this note and take any questions.
If Zimbabwe was abandoned in an orderly fashion, mm-hmm. if the birds were such an important religious relic, mm-hmm. why didn't they take the women? Where did they win?
Good question. But since its abandonment, Great Zimbabwe has also continued to be an important shrine. People go there and perform a number of ceremonies. And also, there is this thing in the Shona world where you respect settlements of the dead, of the deceased. They automatically become shrines. But I take your point that if they were important, then people would have taken them. But unfortunately, or fortunately for us today, they were left. And we are left to play some mental gymnastics, try and find out what were they. And there's also no evidence of those beds whatsoever in any of the entities that succeeded Great Zimbabwe. So they are only a phenomenon of Great Zimbabwe. That's what also complicates the interpretation. But the most viable one seems to be that they represent birds of prey, which were important in communicating with the spirits for the health of the state. There was a question, a hand here. Yes.
Is there evidence that they kept cattle?
There is evidence that they ate cattle. A lot of cattle bone was recovered from the rubbish dumps, but we don't know where their cattle crawls were. And according to Huffman, they wouldn't have kept cattle here because this was an elite pattern. The cattle were somewhere far away, where I don't know, but they were just they were simply not inside the settlement. But there is a lot of cattle bone to suggest that they were eating some of the mice cuts of plant beef. Yes.
Salt.
I mentioned that salt. They abandoned Great Zimbabwe because of a shortage of salt, which is something that comes out in the oral tradition. It might as well be a metaphor. For that we don't know, but it's just a reason that is given. But how many of us can eat food without salt? Unless our doctors told us that no, please don't. How many of us can do that? Let's imagine it's a town of 20,000 people with no salt. What are you going to do? I don't know. Maybe move away. But take it as a metaphor that people just migrated, not that it was just the physical absence of salt. There are so many Brackenfell or saline springs around Great Zimbabwe, and they would have obtained their salt from there. But let's just say it's a miracle. Yes?
You presented some interpretations from the 1980s and 1960s. What do you think is the current...
I was hoping that nobody asked that question. I did a number of papers. One of them actually was a survey of the distribution of material culture, and that's where I came up with the observation that the use, what Huffman says is the use and the function, they don't correlate. And for that, the journal called Antiquity, which is published in Britain, was very generous enough to give me the prize of £2,000 for the best paper, and I bought myself some nice blue John Yorker. But all I'm saying is that what we are doing at the moment is try and do some more work, revise, consolidate some of the observations, starting with what is the nature of the material culture. Believe me, but at the moment there is no database of objects from Greg's model. Nobody really knows what was found from where. All you have to do is to go to those books which were written by Theodore Bert, and lucky enough there is some material which was donated to Cecil John Rhodes, which is his equal. Other than that, the material is scattered all over the world, and nobody knows what is going on, which is probably good, because it means we can speculate more. Yes?
Is there still a system of kingship within these tribes?
Oh, yes, yes.
And where would the king live now?
Well, so many things have, so many developments have taken place since the Western life was introduced in the 1900s. But what is happening these days, or what used to happen in the mid-19th century, was that the king would live in a homestead together with his wives. So there was no separation of wives there, guys there, and so forth. They all lived in one place. And much more importantly, I didn't present to you what the historian David Beach has suggested because of time limitations. But what also happens is that in terms of succession politics, let's say the front row, we are all siblings, and that's our father is the chief, and that we are all men. I'm sorry for that, but it's just an example. So they used what was known as the system of houses, the basis of collateral succession. So succession from father to the eldest son. By which time the eldest son dies, it moves to the second house. That's the second son. And then it goes around, and then it becomes convoluted, such that nobody knows how it started. The materialization of that ideology was such that each and every king could rule from his homestead. So if it is my turn to become king, I don't abandon my homestead to go and live in the or occupy the house of the former king. No, I do that in my own homestead. That's why David Beach then is saying that the shift from the hill to the great enclosure to the valley is perhaps consistent with that succession system. So collateral succession and how it was materialized, that's the short answer to that. The parallel passage. In terms of construction, there is this inner curtain wall, and then they built the outer curtain wall, which gave rise to this parallel passage. That also leads to the valley. So the Huffman interpretation says that when the initiates, particularly the male ones, they would use this and go to the male side. But I'm not so sure, except the only interpretation that I have is just that this is a PQ wall and this is a Q wall. So this is an outer gate wall. It's just the elaboration of the structure over time. Yes?
Is there any evidence of human sacrifice?
Not that I have seen or heard of. I haven't heard anything like that, or even a kettle, or I haven't. But there are a lot of there's a lot of kettle bone, and yeah.
The lintel across that wide doorway.
Mm-hmm.
Of what is that made?
Two things. The litterers on the western enclosure here, they are slabs of stone.